All right, I'll call the meeting to order. If you are here, please check in on the computer. We have 31 board members present. That is a quorum. Let's continue with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please rise for that.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, I have a couple things under the Chair's report. First of all, those of you who have been on the board for a while know that I teach a class over at the university, and once a semester, the Sheriff's Department is gracious enough to give my class a tour of the jail, and I always invite county board members. So any new county board member or any veteran county board member who is interested, the jail tours this year are two Saturdays in a row, November 14th and 21st. If you're interested in touring the existing jail, not the new addition, you should talk to Jim Spiropoulos if you want to do the new addition, but the existing jail, November 14th and 21st at 1 p.m., meet outside the north entrance of the courthouse just a little bit before 1 o'clock. We go in exactly at 1 o'clock, so get there a little bit ahead of time. And I'll remind you as we get closer to that date, but if you're interested, put that on your calendar. I know a number of people have been interested in how one of our colleagues, Arlene Benrode, is doing, and so I'm going to call on Jerry Sobranek to give us an update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just came from talking with her. I have some pictures in here that I'll pass around. She wants to thank all the county supervisors, department heads, county employees that came to see her. Called her and anyway, she's doing fine. She's home now. She got a ride through a Ray Ebert limousine service. So she's doing fine. I have some pictures here with some comments that I'll pass around, and she's home. She's doing just great.
That sounds good.
She thanks everyone.
Give her our best.
I will. Thank you.
All right, Supervisor Conference Reports. Anybody have any? Mr. Bina.
I have two short ones. We were at a RCMD conference. It was a two-day conference in Rhinelander. I went for only one day. During the past 6 months, there was competition for a number of items, a number of people who were working within the organization. I received the Outstanding Council Member for the year, and they gave me a plaque at the convention, which I thought was kind of nice, something to remember. And I could tell you all about the conference. The second day I went to Lakes Conference, setbacks and whatever, conservation, and they talked about ash borers in the other one. But if you want to know what the RCMD is, come and talk to me. I'll explain it in more detail. Today, I just got back from, I was appointed to the state grazing committee. We had a grazing committee, and I should note that there's no expenses for the county on this one. I get it picked up by the RCMD. And they reappropriated $20,000 that was unspent from 2006 to the grazers for fencing, watering, and whatever. So I just got back from that an hour ago.
All right, thank you. Did I see another hand, Vicki Burke?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to impress upon the county supervisors the importance of a visit that's going to be made to La Crosse County by the Urban Institute and National Institute of Corrections on the transitioning from jail to community project that we currently are working on. As I talked about it last week, and I handed out some brochures to you, that is an important project we're working on with the Urban Institute and NIC to see how we might do a better job of transitioning offenders from the jail to community with the hope of reducing reoffending, reducing substance abuse, homelessness, some of those things that that we wish to help offenders, and we think will keep them from reoffending. They are going to be here to talk to the county board at 5:30 on November 9th. That's the night of our public hearing that starts at 6 p.m. But they will be here at 5:30, and they're going to spend 3 days with us, the 9th, the 10th, and the 11th. The Urban Institute is coming. They're coming to us from Washington, D.C., and so they are going to look at our criminal justice system, the continuum of sanctions that are offered, and make some suggestions and help to us in this endeavor. And I hope that all of you could take that time to be here at 5:30. They've made the trip to La Crosse. We're one of 6 counties in the United States that is part of this project, and I hope that you would be here at 5:30 to listen to what they've learned about La Crosse County during the first day of being here, and then to get a better explanation from them about the importance of this project. So would you please put that on your calendar to arrive at 5:30 on the we thought if we scheduled it just before the public hearing, you would be coming in that evening anyway, and we'd have an opportunity for you to meet with that group.
Again, the date is November 9th.
The night of the public hearing, so okay. 5:30. Right here. It'll be they will come here to
here
be
in the boardroom
prior to it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes.
Sounds good. Margaret Wood.
Thank you. I just thought I would let you know last month I was able to see our staff from Health and Human Services very active in the Suicide Prevention Summit. This month I was able to see our extension staff out at the Onalaska Library during their open house, and was amazed to find out the hundreds of kids that are involved in the 4-H program that are from the urban areas, not the rural areas. And then today, again, the Health and Human Services people were really outstanding in our third focus group of the Crisis Assessment, Recovery, and Empowerment Project. And I just am continually impressed with the quality of staff that we have, and how responsive they are to the needs of the community.
Thank you. Any other reports? All righty. That gets us to County Administrator Report.
Thank you, Steve. I've got a couple of quick items before we get into some of the details of the report. I've got an envelope, which is the United Way, that we're going to pass around, which are the actual contribution forms and the tickets. If you do more than $52, you get a raffle ticket for all the prizes that are there, and there is a NCR form. So even if you're not sure you want to contribute but you want to think about it, just take one of the NCR forms and think about it. Work with my office staff, Terry Pavlik. She can finalize that. I just wanted to point out that last year was the largest number of county board members that have given in 5 or 6 years. So if you can continue to maintain that, I think it demonstrates quite clearly that we support the United Way community-wide. These are some of the most difficult times for nonprofit agencies. So even if you're not able to give a great deal, there are a number of us that do give a large amount to the United Way every year, and we try to encourage people to participate. So please, if Bev, would you take that and pass that on? Again, pass it on during the meeting, and if you can turn that in. If it's not during the meeting, you can turn it into my office over the next couple days, or I will collect those at the end of the meeting if you do get a chance to fill it in. Either way, I really appreciate it. And the next item is that on Monday, October 19th, the school board of La Crosse is having what's called a informational dialogue or linkage on their ends and outcomes and policy governance issues. If there are board members here that are interested in attending that, I promise that I would pass it on. I've got I only made 4 because I wasn't.
We sent an email out on that too.
You sent an email out on it. Okay.
I don't know if anybody responded though, but Margaret sent it out on my behalf.
So I do have more details on that. I made 4 copies in case there are board members that happen to be in the La Crosse School District that would like to have more interaction with them on their goals and objectives and how they're using policy governance. That's this Monday night at 5 o'clock. And so I've got these copies as well if someone wants those. Okay, no questions. The first item under my report, I'm actually just going to turn over to Jerry Huber, is an update on the provider selection in the Crisis Assessment Center. So, Jerry, if you'd come up, and the Human Services Board members know about this, but we wanted the full board to be aware of what's going on with this.
Good evening. Five quick points, and then Jerry indicated that she has quite a few questions, so we'll see how long I'll be up here. First of all, the vendor has been selected. This is a process that Melissa Gilbert, our project coordinator, has been working on since January. Our vendor is Tellurian out of Madison. I think we got good press coverage in the last couple of weeks, and we appreciate that. We actually had first time to meet with Tellurian today for a few hours. Am I on or am I not on?
Okay, sorry about that. We met with the vendor. Actually, this is a time that a lot of work has to be done. And so what we're hoping for is that most of that work could be done in 4 to 5 months. Our target date, I think, still is the first quarter of 2010 to get this started. The focus group, I think, had probably about 60 or 70 people there today, about 4 or 5 board members, which we appreciate. The experts of this program have really been Melissa Gilbert, the project coordinator, and Dean Rupert, our operations administrator, so in case there's any questions. I want to talk a little bit about probably the most critical issue is the site location. Joe Cruz from Franciscan SCAMP, who's part of the steering committee, recommended that we're going to form a subcommittee of community leaders from both of the hospitals, from law enforcement, probably from the neighborhood associations also, and work with us over the next few months so we don't necessarily get in the same thing that we did in terms of Women's Alternative. Tellurian has indicated is that they have done this in many different communities in developing kind of a crisis assessment center. One of the things that they guaranteed me is that there always be some aspect of NIMBY issues, not in my backyard. So I don't think we're going to avoid that altogether, but what we're going to try to do is mitigate that as much as possible. The other thing I would indicate is that in order to make this successful, we have averaged about 750 detentions in terms of what's called Chapter 51 detentions per year. About 550 happen in La Crosse. This is critical that the assessment center actually is in the city of La Crosse. We made that clear to the city, to law enforcement, and to the hospitals. So that's what we're working on. I think that's basically kind of the update. And again, the press has done a good job in covering that. We'll take any questions, and I could rely on Melissa and Dean to help me out here.
Question for Jerry? Mr. Bina.
So you said it should be in La Crosse, but you also have 250 people or 200 people from out county. Wouldn't it make sense that we could utilize some area out to Lakeview and have the staff go there when needed? Maybe they already live out there. I can't tell you where they live.
It's a good question, Don. And one of the things that we're looking at is really the first site has to be in the city of La Crosse in order to work with the Sheriff's Department. What we're looking at is maybe developing satellite offices, which could include Lakeview. And we've been working with Pam and Wanda on that as well. So.
Jeff Schrader, did you have your hand up?
I did. What was the total number, Jerry? Was it 700 and what?
Yeah. Since I came here in 1998, we've been averaging about 750 detentions per year, which is per capita one of the highest in the state of Wisconsin.
And what do you attribute that to? I mean, what, it's so much higher than the rest of the state.
One of the things, and we talked to law enforcement about this, is what I call the convenience factor. You know, law enforcement becomes very concerned about liability of anybody that, you know, is indicating suicide, basically gesturing suicide. So they feel to cover their liability, they have to bring somebody over to the emergency room. Interesting enough, smaller counties, they don't have the convenience of the hospitals, so they find out that they have other ways of trying to address it. The convenience factor is good for us in the fact that, you know, hopefully we could prevent suicide. On the other hand, it's a significant cost to the county in terms of the number of detentions that we do have.
Sharon Hampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for perspective's sake, how much does it cost for those detentions?
Well, every year it goes up, and the average is about $600 to $700 just basically for the placement at the hospital, not including psychiatric services. If we didn't have hospital beds available, placement at Mendota State Hospital would be over $1,000 a day.
So that, in theory, is where we're looking to find the funds to fund
correct
this center. Right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Ralph Geary.
Thank you. You said the smaller counties do something else. What do they do?
Bring them to La Crosse. No, that's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but sometimes that's actually the case. Actually, the counties around us do use Franciscan and Gunderson. Their number of placements are considerably smaller just because of their size. Just recently, the last couple of years, that they developed more crisis services similar to what we have. But they struggle. One or two placements of somebody at Mendota State Hospital will break Monroe's budget in Vernon County. They simply don't have a big enough budget to support this. I should also indicate, as Ralph, one of the things that we're looking at is developing this as a regional alternative, but first to begin in La Crosse and then develop it regionally.
Jeff Schrader.
Thanks. So these people are first taken to the jail?
No, not to the jail.
Not to the jail.
Usually right now to the emergency room at either one of the hospitals. Our goal is that they may be brought to the hospital first, but then diverted to the crisis assessment center. Our law enforcement will have the opportunity to bring them directly to the crisis assessment center and not to the emergency room.
Do they have some sort of directives or some sort of guidelines that they go by before they take these people?
Right now, the guidelines is that law enforcement is the only one that could place anybody on to detention. And so, again, if they feel that the person is going to be harmful to themselves or others, that's a criteria in Wisconsin statute. They have to be harmful to themselves or others in order to be detained on emergency detention. But maybe my definition may be very different than law enforcement's definition in terms of who is harmful or who is suicidal. What we're hoping to do, if there's one provision in the governor's budget that helped us a lot, is now counties have the responsibility to determine the appropriateness of emergency detention under Chapter 51. Before that, it was law enforcement. So the rules have changed a bit in our favor.
Anybody else? Monica Cruz.
Thank you. Do you have a lot of repeat clients? I mean, do you have sort of a revolving door syndrome?
We assume that we do. We talk to the hospitals. We call them frequent flyers. They're probably more within the context of needing detox services than necessarily mental health services. I thought there were a lot for mental health, but the chronically mentally ill are in programs like community support program where they have a crisis plan available to them. Social workers see them on a daily basis. So the medications are monitored. Basically, their behavior is monitored. And actually, there's not a lot of frequent flyers because of that program.
Good question. Anybody else? Ralph Geary?
Well, you touched on that liability thing. Mm-hmm. I thought we were protected or immune or something. If you place them incorrectly and something happens, do we get sued? Because doesn't that just force us to put them in the most restrictive thing we can to just protect ourselves? Or are we protected?
Yeah.
With hundreds of cases, like once in a while, you're going to probably guess wrong.
Right. When I talked a lot about liability, that's the issue that law enforcement feels, that if they're the first agency of contact and they make a decision not to place somebody under detention and the person suicides, then the liability is on law enforcement. Now, with the governor's action in terms of county approval of that, the liability comes back primarily on the county. And actually, that's something that we wanted because we wanted to have the ability to control the gate of people going into detention.
Keep saying liability. What's the liability? I thought.
Let me have Bill answer that question. Bill, I think his question is, can we get sued if we make the wrong call?
Well, certainly you can always get sued. We do have immunity for discretionary acts. So, and I think that the immediacy of the release of these folks indicates that a lot of this is discretionary. So there is discretionary immunity under Wisconsin law. It's only when an act becomes ministerial, something that we are mandated to do. But I think in these cases, I've been involved in mental commitment since 1973, and to my knowledge, we have not had one lawsuit that's evolved from that. So I think we've been doing appropriate things for many, many years.
Thank you. You've been involved since 73. How many suicided?
I mean, certainly there have been suicides. I'm not trying to claim that, but nobody has said that a suicide was caused because of some negligence on the part of county employees. So there's a big difference. I mean, it's pretty hard to prevent every suicide, and I'm no expert on that, but I'm sure.
Well, the first lawsuit that I was involved with, where I was personally named in the lawsuit, we had an adolescent that hung himself in foster care when I was in Minnesota. And normally how liability goes is that everybody that's involved in the case is named to see if anybody was negligent in regards to the case. This case is a case that literally went on for about 5 or 6 years in terms of liability. So I think there's always the aspect that somebody, some attorney, can sue. And you know, I think that's the thing that we're trying to avoid. The one thing I think that we do have in La Crosse County is that we have more of an array in a continuum of services than most counties do have. And again, I think that's a benefit to keeping people healthy and safe.
Tom Bina.
I guess I just have one more question, and that is, I said on long-term care, and I heard the explanation, and I'm not opposed to any of this, but the groups that met are hoping that the funding by incorporating this is enough to cover the costs of the RFP and the system and whatever. And I guess at some point in time, I'd like to see the bottom line on whether you could live with that budget, or if it's exceeding the budget, then you got to take it out of the general fund or something. So at some point in time, sure. Down the road, I'd like to get a report on that.
Yeah, me too. the only issue that I would say, Don, with that is that there's a cost of not doing it. And the governor imposed that, in essence, counties now have to pay the full non-federal share of anybody going into Mendota. So that's $500, $600 a day. And the other issue is that Franciscan Scamp, who has the most inpatient beds, significantly downsized their beds in the last few years. It's not uncommon on a weekend that both of the inpatient units are full. Therefore, if anybody is potentially suicidal and law enforcement places somebody, they're going to go down to Mendota, and basically the cost is going to be borne by the taxpayer. At county levy caps and basically $1.3 million cut when in the context of our budget, my opinion that this is a risk that we had to take.
We still have the beds at the hospital
then? If they're available. We don't lock into any beds. So if the other counties are using them, and we have somebody in La Crosse that's potentially suicidal, that, you know where they're going.
Tara Johnson.
My one and only question.
That's good there.
Others did such a good job of asking them. What would be most helpful that county board supervisors could be doing in the next weeks and months to support this program?
The thing that we constantly hear in concerns about is, again, the NIMBY issue. And I think it's a little bit premature. What we want to do is to have the community leaders beyond the board get involved with this. We constantly have indicated that this is an issue of concern not for La Crosse County only. It's for law enforcement, it's for the hospitals, it's for the general safety of the community. And what we're hoping for is that the hospitals, and particularly La Crosse law enforcement, will get involved and help us with the site selection. Tellurian has done this over and over and over again in Madison, Janesville, other communities. So they're familiar with the particular issue, but I don't want to make light of the fact that this is going to be something that we're going to have to work together on, particularly with the board's involvement eventually as well. I think that probably is the most critical one that we're going to face right now.
Jeff Schrader again.
Thank you. This is my third question. Jerry, at one time there was talk of the overflow people, whatever you want to call them, before they would be sent to Mendota, that they would be possibly sent to Lakeview if some sort of a certification was gotten, the debtor go into place?
I developed, I'm trying to look at Fred Pan, is it two beds? I think we developed two beds, crisis beds within Lakeview and then several also at Trampolo. One of the biggest issues I think that we face with that is transportation-related issues for law enforcement. And particularly most of these placements are happening late at night, and law enforcement really has limited ability and capacity to haul somebody over to Lakeview. I think we've used maybe several times the crisis beds as far as I remember. It was more of an issue with the hospitals and emergency room doctors who feel as soon as somebody crosses the threshold of an emergency room, the liability shifts from law enforcement into the hospital. And with federal laws, that's called EMTALA rules. So it's everybody's saying it's your liability, it's your liability. And what we're trying to say is it's the community's liability to keep people safe.
Bridget Flood.
Thank you. Jerry, I think I remember that one of the things that will be done with this crisis center is that a crisis team will be able to interview these people and determine whether, in fact, they do need to be detained. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Right now, we have a mobile crisis team. The problem that we've had is that we haven't had utilization of that team to the effectiveness that we wanted to reduce emergency detentions.
Okay.
And I indicate, and I've talked to the press about this and law enforcement, we have a tendency to have a little bit of an institutional bias that law enforcement feels comfortable bringing somebody to the jail, to the hospitals. And so what we had to do is kind of play into that institutional bias a little bit and create a center where people could go that the law enforcement feels is safe, not only safe for the person, but safe for the community. And that's why we developed that, but it'll be woven into our crisis assessment team.
I'd like to comment on that then. Hmm. Back in the day when I worked in juvenile detention, we used to get kids that we assessed ourselves as being in crisis. And so then the crisis team would come up and they'd sit and they'd talk to them and they knew the questions to ask and they knew the plans to make with the kids, and all of a sudden the kid was no longer in crisis. And that to me is, that takes care of a great deal of liability when you know that kid is no longer in crisis. And then it would be the same with adults. And also I just think money-wise, boy, we really got to sell this because I really think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And correct me if I'm wrong, Bridget, but I don't think we've had one successful suicide in a JDF since it's opened in 1990.
Anybody else? Any other questions? All right, Jerry, thank you very much.
You.
Very helpful.
Mr. Chair, I've got a couple of rather lengthy reports that I plan to do, but I just recognized out of due respect there's a member of the public waiting for a planning resources development item. I'd suggest that the board move the planning resources development items up. They're welcome to stay for the other report items, but out of respect, I'd ask that.
Any objection to going to Planning Resource and Development Committee? Seeing none, that's where we're at. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have item 7-10, zoning petition 1822, filed by Stephen and Rita Simon to remove the conditional zoning condition for only single family residents on land zoned commercial agricultural district A in the town of Unalaska. The committee voted unanimously to approve this. I move for your approval.
Mr. Meyer moves the committee report, which is to approve, seconded by Mr. Montai. Any discussion or questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously.
Item 8-10, zoning petition 1826, filed by Gary and Carrie Johnson to rezone from exclusive agriculture district to agriculture district A in the town of Farmington. I would move for your approval on this. After I get a second, I'd like to explain something in the minutes.
Mr. Meyer moves for approval, seconded by Mr. Bina.
Okay, I don't know who's read the minutes and who hasn't, But the first part of the minutes says that the department denies this request. But if you follow the minutes a little further on to the next page, you'll find that we found a way to work this out for the citizen by changing this to conditional zoning, and he would then be able to build what he wanted. I asked Gary about it. He said he understood it, and he didn't want to build another house there anyway. So with that, I move for your approval.
So what you're saying is the department then changed its position to support it?
Yes, I guess you could say. They didn't really say that, but the committee voted that way, yes.
All right. Any question, comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously.
Item 9-10, conditional use permit number 1802, filed by Dale and Doris Masowski, acting in behalf of Lori and Brian Masowski and Lucy McRoberts, on the construction and operate a 45-foot wind tower for a single-family residence to be connected to the local grid on land zoned exclusive agriculture district in the town of Greenfield. The committee approved this unanimously with four conditions, and I move for your approval.
Mr. Meyer moves the committee report, which is to approve with the conditions, seconded by Margaret Wood. Discussion or questions? Maureen Friedland.
I just had a question about this one, please. Why was the minimum of 50 feet placed on it? I was wondering if that was following a town regulation or what was it? I see that as it is right now, it's 60 feet in one direction and 150 in another direction. I'm just wondering where this came from, because the idea in the issue of setbacks is so current now with windmills and wind towers.
The answer man, Mr. Blesky, is definitely
expert witness.
The reason this condition was placed on it was for safety. Even though the tower is rated for, I believe it's a certain wind, 140 mile an hour winds, if the thing ever toppled, we didn't want it to hit any surrounding building or fall onto any adjacent property, which it's not going to anyway, but it's a safety issue. That's all it is.
Any other questions?
We've done that on cell towers as well.
Okay. John Menninger.
Well, I noticed that you're making them take out the existing windmill. You know, there ain't many of them left. They're kind of historic. What's the reasoning for that?
That's discussed in the minutes as well. I think the company that wants to help them put up this tower, originally the landowners wanted to put the rotor on top of the windmill, but they said that they wouldn't construct it there. So this is, again, just a safety issue, and it's going to be in the same spot that the windmill is.
Any other questions? All in favor of approval with those conditions, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Is that it for you, Mr. Meyer?
That's it, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll go back to County Administrator's report.
Thank you. I noticed that they probably didn't want to stay through all this, but you are welcome. I just...
Get out while you can, though.
Women and children first, yes. Okay, bear with me. We carried this report over from policy planning the other night because of football time constraints and another items that I included here. The first item I wanted to touch on was our annual update of the per capita rankings. That's a green sheet that's in your packet. Also, Supervisor Friedland, yes, I will complete a detailed list of accomplishments that you can share with constituents, so that will be at the November meeting. I know each of you like to have some list of things that you can report back to the public. I got this done in time. The next one will be in November. But I just wanted to highlight a couple of things, because we're always struggling to maintain a low cost of providing county government, but this allows us to be able to show in comparison. The last most comprehensive study that was done over a period of time is still the most definitive study, which is by Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, which shows that from over the first 5 years of this decade, our cost of spending and our cost of government rose slower than virtually the vast majority of counties, and I've provided that data before, but this is the the most current data on per capita levy spending done for just this calendar year 2009. We continue to be the fifth lowest in total county levy taxes per capita. The average in Wisconsin is $397, or almost 60% higher per person than La Crosse County. We're the sixth lowest county operating levy. You may recall that we used to be lower in operating levy. We ended up raising the operating levy because we refinanced, we paid off the highway shop, we did a number of things that added to our operating levy authority. But remember, taxpayers don't pay based on operating levy. They pay based on total taxes. So we continue right now to be the fifth lowest per capita levy compared to all 72 counties. Also at the bottom of the page then is where the 58th out of 72 counties lowest tax rate. Remember the discussion last, one of our last policy planning meetings? Tax rate is determined by your spending and what your total tax base is. If you have a whole lot of tax base, you can have a very low tax rate. Let me use as an example. Door County, who is one of the highest per capita spending counties in the upper graph, has one of the lowest rates. They have about a $7 billion total tax base for a county that's about one-third our size. Their tax rate is 317. Our tax rate is 372 in 2009 because our tax base is about 7.7. Almost identical to Door County, their rate is lower because they have a lot more tax base. One of the challenges that we have is to maintain a low tax rate, even based on what we try to do with lowering our spending, is that the average tax base in the other 16 low tax rate counties is $5.3 billion more, almost, 70% higher than La Crosse. So that shows what a history we have of controlling taxes and impacting having one of the lowest tax rates, even though we don't have as much tax base as many other counties. That's not doom and gloom. That's not saying we're not doing as well as we might. But in comparison, other counties that have a low tax rate actually have a lot more tax base to spread their costs out over than us, just statistically. Then if you flip over to the other side, just wanted to, again, keep our updated comparison because, again, the most comparable comparisons are those that are providing services to a similar size population. Our levy, not adjusted for inflation, not adjusted for per capita or anything, is almost $12 million less than the average for other counties of our size. These are the counties closest in population to La Crosse County, those with populations above us, four counties above us and four counties below us in size population. And then I also compared the per capita for those same counties for total tax levy and the tax rates then. So again, in a number of different versions, you can see that based on the current 2009 budget, our average levy for similar sized counties is about $96 more per person in another county than it would be living in La Crosse. And for a $100,000 home, you would be paying on average $69 more if you lived in one of those average counties with that those tax rates. So again, I try to update this each year just to provide you that information when taxpayers or constituents are asking you how we're doing. I think it's important to keep this information up to date.
Mr. Vina.
I guess there's one thing I'd kind of like to know. Out of these comparable counties, you know, we maybe have an advantage because we have a fairly good-sized sales tax income. How do we rate with those counties as far as sales taxes are concerned? Because nobody ever talked about that. Are they comparable, or are they less, or are they more?
Actually, we're to a point now where there's only 9 or 10 counties, I think, with Fond du Lac just doing what they did to save Mercury Marine, instituting the sales tax. I think there will only be 9 counties that haven't done that. I didn't update that, but I have done that each year, by the way. We don't have up-to-date sales tax numbers. The point is that our ranking doesn't change that drastically once you add those counties, and we still maintain in the lowest 15 on a per capita basis. When we get new sales tax numbers, I can certainly update that. But we're always in the lowest grouping, even accounting for that. But it's getting to the point where more and more counties are not able to not institute the sales tax. Obviously, the sales tax has been good for us in controlling property taxes. $9.7 million per year is our projection for this budget. It'll probably come in at about 9.4, 9.5. That helps a great deal right to the bottom line. That helps a lot in controlling property taxes. So that's no. Actually, remember last year's table. I actually did it. If every county didn't have sales tax, and if every county did, we were still in the bottom 10 to 12 counties. I didn't update that this year, but
Terry Johnson.
But either way, we are still among the lowest in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do any of our eight comparable counties not have a sales tax?
Boy, I didn't bring that file, but yes, there are a couple of them. Sheboygan, for example, does not have, they're one of the largest counties that does not. Fond du Lac does not, but they're just instituting it. Eau Claire does, La Crosse does, I believe Dodge does. So I think it's only those three counties that do not.
Thank you.
Ralph Geary.
Well, we've been citing these statistics for years, but the most comparable county we have is Eau Claire because we're the only two in western Wisconsin. I remember sitting on negotiations, Walworth. Why are they out of whack? They're between Chicago and Milwaukee. So their wage structure is way different than ours to hire people because I sat on personnel. Bob told us that Walworth, on all the bargaining or whatever, with binding arbitration just to get people to work there to stop from going to Milwaukee or eastern part of the state. And other counties may have a lot more county miles, a lot more county road miles. La Crosse County law enforcement, we're not the primary law enforcement. We have more police officers than the city of La Crosse. Onalaska's got a large police force. In some counties, county law enforcement may be the primary enforcement agency. In La Crosse County, it's not. So, you know, you look at this, sitting at these other counties, their administrator or somebody's telling them why they're is so good or why they're
actually I think I'm the only one that does the statewide analysis of counties all 72, so I'm not aware that the other
I've talked to these people from Walworth and stuff when they're at the convention. I've talked to them numerous times and about that problem they have just due to their location.
Sure.
Anybody else questions? All right.
Okay, the next item then is to do the report that I was going to do the other night. Linda, if you could bring the slides up. I've added just a couple of brief slides, but it's virtually everything that you got from your last policy planning meeting, so hopefully you brought that agenda packet. I do appreciate you bearing with breaking this up into two nights. We did go over this with the executive committee, so those of you that are on executive committee, bear with. I want to take adequate time for the full board to see this. I won't spend as much time on the county road situation since we had Denny Osgood and Keith are both here to be able to answer questions on that if we get into some of the details. If we could switch to the slide view, maybe I can. Yes, perfect. Thanks. Okay, as I highlighted at the last meeting, and I just want to kind of remind everybody where we were in September when I brought you the county administrator's budget, and the document that you have in front of you is a balanced budget. I believe it makes good, sound decisions overall, and while you still may end up making amendments in it and give different direction, I think it's a good, positive plan for La Crosse County for 2010. However, as you know, when we got to the end of that presentation, I said I'm still troubled by some of the challenges that it leaves us into the future. It gives a number of difficult situations to us for dealing with in 2011, and I said I was still looking at some additional options. And with that in mind, I prepared basically what I'm going to present to you tonight, and I asked for a meeting with Steve Doyle and Tara Johnson and Joe Veenstra, the chair, first vice chair, and second vice chair, and I asked, what do you think about me presenting this idea as an alternative to the proposed budget? And they said, sure, let's see what the full county board and the executive committee have to see. Because with each one of the challenges that we talked about, there are ways of trying to address this rather than just postponing this till the next county board deals with these major challenges in 2011. And it gives us some options of what to deal with. So just to hopefully you've had a chance to read this. So I'm not going to read every single word, but I want to kind of walk through where we're at. The major challenges following the 2010 budget, if you adopt it close to what I've presented in the administrator's budget, is number one, the Lakeview levy may now be too low to pay our share in the future if the Mississippi Valley Health Services rate is increased. One of the things we're going to be discussing with the Mississippi Valley Health Services Board next week is whether or not they're willing to sustain a slightly larger increase. We're going to discuss what the pros and cons are of that rate, and I'm going to address that in just a few minutes. But while I've got your attention on this, we just, as of about 4 o'clock yesterday, received wonderful news. I won't go into it in a lot of detail, but the Attorney General has opined that the commission form for a multi-county operation of a nursing home does comply with state law. We're still having our corp counsel and Andy Phillips from MVHS review the details. It was about 11-page opinion, but the conclusion was that we are on the right track in what we're able to do, which is really critical because we do have the license from the state. We now have an opinion from the Attorney General that indicates that we're on the right track. We may have to make some minor adjustments in that. We're still reviewing that right now, but that is just some of the best news that we've had in quite some time. I know Pam and I were emailing back and forth, so it means that we still have room to go, but we can continue with this. So the point number one is that if we increase MVHS rate, remember, we have to pay the same rate as other counties for our clients that are at Lakeview as they do. And that's part of the point, is that it is not Medicaid supplementation if the counties are jointly sharing in the cost of operation based on who they've got in the facility. That's the whole basic concept. So if we're not meeting the bottom line in MVA in Lakeview, we may have to raise the rate. The highway capital improvement needs are unmet in the future, and policy choices for other funding must be addressed. Whether we kick the can ahead to the next county board or we start to deal with it now, we need to find other ways of looking for funding of roads and helping us get through the situations that Denny described, and that, of course, the La Crosse Tribune had a very good detailed article describing a lot of those challenges just this past weekend. Number three, raising taxes for debt for payment for highways, if that were to be a choice, would be problematic since we're still paying off the old law enforcement center. One of the difficulties that we continue to struggle with is that we needed to make a decision that was adding on to the law enforcement center before we had the existing one paid off. So it's straining our ability to, at least conservatively, have taxes pay for debt service. You certainly have the legal authority to raise taxes to do that. But as we've discussed, with a declining tax base or a flat tax base, as we expect to be experiencing over the next several years, raising taxes for debt would still be a problem. And the potential for the rate freeze is likely in 2011 if equalized value declines, unless we can cut our operating levy in some way, shape, or form. So these challenges get addressed in the alternative that I'm going to talk about. But you need to understand, I believe, a little bit about how we set the Mississippi Valley Health Services rate and why that number one challenge is even an issue. The Mississippi Valley Health Services rate, the first ever done in this state or anywhere in the country that we believe, a multi-county collaboration where jointly we share in a rate or an assessment rate per patient day, we've set it at $39.35. But in order to be fair to the other counties and to ourselves, the methodology we set the rate up on was based on 2006. So in 2008, we set the rate based on the last closed financial statement, meaning the 2006 audited financial statement. It didn't include and doesn't include all of the costs, but when you're in mid-budget year, you don't know exactly what the final determinant is going to be. It has the effect of minimizing the rate so that members, other counties including ourselves, would benefit from all other revenues like certified public expenditure, extra IGT, any of those kinds of things that are basically not based on projections, but are new kind of windfalls, so to speak, to the bottom line that increase your cash balance. So the rate is always 2 years behind actual costs and doesn't end up dealing with other ways that costs increase, like wages, the increased bed tax. The increased bed tax, for example, is going to be a major impact on the 2010 operations at Lakeview, passed by the state that's supposedly going to supplement part of the Medicaid rate, but the Medicaid rate is never sufficient. No matter how much you raise the bed tax, you never make it up in volume on the cost of operations, or a lower census. Lakeview will first access Mississippi Valley Health Services revenue in this calendar year. Remember, last year we weren't able to access it and count on it because we hadn't gotten the license, we hadn't got the AG opinion, we weren't in a position to actually be able to count on it. So if you would turn to page 109 of your budget book, I want to kind of walk you through that. We are doing this actually with the three new supervisors in orientation, and Monica said this was actually quite helpful. If you go to the far right-hand column, and you'll see on page 109, total revenues of $9,850,000, total expenses of $13,248,000. Again, this is all for 2010, with a net levy of $1,387,000. Now, if you go back to 2009 projected and go down that column, total revenues are $9.9 million. Total expenses are $12.5 million, and if you go down to the bottom of the page where we have to make this balance, $1,009,000, which is the levy that you set in this budget, you'll notice just above that revenue from MVHS, $850,000. That's the first year we've been able to use that revenue, because last year when we set this budget, we couldn't count on it because we hadn't had approval to actually release that money. So that allowed us to actually preserve a little bit of cash and be in a position to be able to move ahead. But it's always 1 year behind us. It's not the current year. And that'll get relevant as I get just a little bit forward.
At some point in time, I guess.
Yep.
I don't know when
you want it. Do you want to do it now?
Might as well do them a step at a time. I'm hoping the slides build on each other. So.
Okay.
You are using figures that are 2 years old in regards to putting the expenses into the system.
In setting the rate.
Which
right.
will tell me that we're always, forever, going to be 2 years behind. We're always and forever going to be looking at a deficit, if that's the case. With a new institution like we just are getting approved of, shouldn't you use the most common rate? And will that rate scare the heck out of the rest of the counties and force them away from us?
That's exactly the question that we're having, and that's what I'm trying to lead you to, is to understand the dynamics around that, is that one of the things that we've started to explore with counties is if we don't set it 2 years back, we're not getting enough money to cover costs. If we have to put the expense to the actual rate, which I'll show you in a little bit later slide, are they still willing to be there? We had a meeting October 7th with the human services directors representing the majority of those counties, and they indicated positively that they're willing to consider a higher rate as long as they don't have surprise admissions, as long as we're not keeping people longer than they need to, and so we're working through that. So you're exactly on the same track, Don, is we don't want to be in a position, which is why we are conservative in setting the initial rate, of scaring anybody away. At the same time, unless we actually set it on actual costs and things don't keep changing drastically, we're not going to be able to make this up over time. So that's where we're trying to take this.
But if we're going to be looking year after year after year at $1,003,000 coming out of our own pockets, that might be a bigger problem in the future than it is right now.
Let me just stop you there. The issue is we will always have to levy a tax, as far as I can tell,
probably
for our clients,
well,
for those 56% of the Lakeview clients that are ours.
I agree.
And but we want to make sure that the rate is set sufficient that the other 44% of people from the other counties are paying their full share, and that's what we're trying to get to. Because this was a brand new idea, because we were trying to be as conservative as possible in the methodology, and because, quite frankly, we had a couple of good years of unanticipated CPE and other things that were coming to our cash position, we were able to be conservative on the rate. So we're trying to work with them to come up with a different methodology.
Could we renegotiate 1 year back instead of two? There could be some options.
That's the discussion we're having. So just hold on to those thoughts, but that's exactly where we're going.
Good.
Okay? So the 2010 budget was based on then we know what we're receiving in 2009 MVHS revenue. We know we can count on that. So you'll see in the last column about $800,000. It might be a little bit more than that, but we used that because I believed in this budget that I had to do something to lower the Lakeview levy because there's no other way to make the whole budget balance. And in reviewing all of this, I've come back and said I may have cut too much, and that's what I'm going to try to get to. So,
thank you, sir. Yeah, I noticed down there that from land sales we showed $240,000, and it seems to me that any time you start to sell assets to support operating
right.
levy, that's not a great idea. I guess I'd rather see that go for capital improvements because, again, for operating, it's
boy,
really a terrible idea.
We're in sync. In this budget includes capital improvements, and that 240 is directly tied into capital, which is in page 5 of the Goldenrod, which lists all the capital improvements for there. So it's exactly one-time only items.
How was that for a nice softball?
Yeah, thank you.
You guys are twins.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The twins lost. Okay, never mind. Finally, in 2011, the Mississippi Valley Health Services rate will have to be higher and expenses lower. We frankly have to relook at what the mix is of number of beds, what how we maintain census. Do we have enough? If we're going to have the same number of beds in Mississippi at Lakeview, maybe we need to have more counties be members because sometimes our census isn't at full census. If we're going to downsize those beds, is it enough to meet our needs, and can we replace it with other services like we've already started to do that will build our bottom line, meaning that we'll generate more revenue and have less expense? So our engagement with the Human Services Directors on October 7th, and will be a continued discussion next week at Mississippi Valley Health Services Board, is how do we right-size Lakeview to meet the needs of MVHS and make sure that we don't make too many changes that will end up harming our ability to operate, but make sure to keep reducing what our overall levy is, whether it's paid for by other counties or us. The concept with the AG's opinion is we're all in this together. And they're still there. They're not scared by talking about a higher rate. They want to make sure we've got a long-term plan to deal with that. We won't solve this over the next 30 days, but we'll continue to expand the dialogue with them. But the point is that if we don't start to address this now, we may, in La Crosse County, have to raise the 2011 rate so much that we're not able to do that. Well, and that is not a good position to be in. In essence, and I tried to do this visually, this isn't in your packet, what I'm trying to do is show you how the application of the revenue is actually delayed. So while it sounds like a crisis, you actually have enough time that if you don't agree with this option, we have one more year or 2 years to deal with this. But the point is that if we start to deal with it now, we actually have more option. If we can get a slight increase in the rate this year, it will actually give us more money to help deal with this because it's not at such a big jump up in the next couple of years. So in the 2008, which the rate was at 39.35, we actually received $850,000 that we couldn't access. It helped us in the 2009 budget after we set the levy. So it actually preserves cash even though we levied that same amount, that $1,000,009. Same thing here in 2009 when we came to the partners and we said, let's leave the rate the same until we see what happens with the license, the AG's opinion, everything else. And so this year we're counting on $800,000 to there. So in 2010, then, we haven't counted on the money that we will receive next year. Okay, we'll have new revenue coming in. We'll probably exceed, by the way, our projection is, we'll probably exceed that $800,000 by a little bit, but again, we wanted to be conservative. So we'll have more to carry over, plus a little bit of cash in Lakeview's balance. I don't mean to talk, accounting, but there are a number of complicated things here that will end up benefiting us financially. So we're not that close. The issue is that in 2011, you only have that $800,000 plus whatever the new rate is. That's not enough to make up the deficit. So you end up having to raise the rate drastically. So if I go to the next one, whoops, can you back that up just one? It jumped ahead. This particular slide I modified in the next page because with the aging long-term care, there was some confusion about what I meant by deficit and rate needed. Revenues is all revenues that we receive from everything other than property taxes or other counties. Expenses are and this also is from page 109, so they're not brand new numbers, is every expense that you have out there, including capital, including wages, including anything you spend on. Deficit is what has to be made up by property taxes. Property taxes are us and the other counties. That's the only place you can get money from after these categories. So deficit is that. And then total patient days is our estimate of the existing total number of patient days. What you'll notice is what's bad about this picture are two things. Revenues are flat. See that? They actually went down is our estimate. Deficit actually goes up substantially, and the rate needed in 09, if we just didn't have any cash balance, we didn't have prior years, should be closer to $50 a day instead of 39. In 2010, again, if you didn't have any cash balance, you didn't have, should be closer to $66. Or we need to do something on the revenue side or lowering the expenditures. That's not an issue we're going to solve in the next 30 days. But it is something that if we right size and change the number of beds or get more partners that can fill those beds or change them out of nursing home or facility for development of disabled beds into something that's a state licensed only or has a direct revenue stream not reliant on Medicaid, we can increase that revenue number and decrease that deficit. I've got more hands.
Terry Johnson.
These are the same numbers.
How does that $66 rate compare to what we initially said to MVHS?
$39.35.
That was
right.
That was what we said all along. We didn't say it might get.
We said $39.35 is where we're starting. We have capital issues. We have ongoing issues that until we get all the clear licensing and approval, we're not going to keep adjusting the rate and drive our partners away. Back to Supervisor Bina's point.
So the meeting next week that you have with them will be the first time that they see this number?
Oh,
unless,
they
of course,
actually,
they read about it in the
no,
paper or something.
No, they actually have it in their agenda packet, and we've okay. talked that the numbers, in fact, the Human Services Director saw all these numbers
they
just
did.
Last
That's
week.
That's what I was getting
right.
at. So
and they still know that our position is we're not necessarily requiring an increase in rate. They were actually the ones that pushed back and said, if you've got financial challenges, let's look at could we do
how
an increased rate.
Help. Okay, right. Thank you.
Mr. Bina.
The one thing on the other slide, it showed $13 million worth of expenditures. Mm-hmm. That doesn't include any improvements that we're going to be maybe considering in the future of $9 million.
It includes the capital that's in this budget. We'll get to that.
Okay, good.
Yeah, sorry. Previous, there you go. And go back two slides. Okay, there we go, thanks. The $13 million includes all capital, all expenses, and if you look at the Goldenrod pages, page 5, which is Lakeview, in the back of your book, that includes about $493,685 of capital for this year. You're exactly right that in addition to this, one of the long-term capital issues is the building, okay? But we're not going to get to that until we determine the right sizing of the services. Let's say, for example, that we decide that right sizing means 100 beds in the nursing home instead of 100 and, what is it, 142? Let's say that everybody only wants us to be at that level and we don't continue to maintain a wing of Lakeview. I'm not saying that's what we're going to do, but that wing of Lakeview could be converted like we did with the CBRF or the state licensed only beds that has a different revenue stream that helps that top number there without changing drastically the expenditures, so it frees up money in the deficit picture. Okay, so we can do that. But to do that, we have to invest $300,000 in remodeling that wing. Okay, so we have to make a cost-benefit analysis on that decision. That's the complexity we're going to get into for the 2011 budget.
Are we going to, after we get certified, are we going to have the state come in and review our building and say, oh boy, you need to do this, this, and this now? Can they do that?
That's part of licensing on all kinds of things. I could ask Pam to come up and talk about each time
okay.
that we've done the state license only beds, Ravenwood, each one of the other services that are there, that's exactly what happens. In fact, that's basically what happens with Pam and her group is that we have so many different services out there. It's like they have a different review. from time. Different licensing parts. Am I describing that right? Every other month. But we're hoping we make it up in the state license only beds are not capped at Medicaid rates. They actually pay for the full cost, and they help our bottom line. You know, each one of the areas actually helps our bottom line instead of the parts that are tied to Medicaid.
So they could come in and say you need $2 million worth of improvements here before we're going to certify you, and we'd have to do that and then put it on the expenditure part.
Right, and we'd have to make sure that it was cost-effective to do that. Right. Okay, the other part to this slide, and I broke it down in more detail, and I'll make copies of these additional slides, but is we took total patient days and divided it out by La Crosse County patient days, which is right now, it's again an estimate because we haven't completed 2009, and 2010 is only a guesstimate, but it gives you an idea that if our rate was $50 a day, La Crosse County's levy would have to be about $1.4 million. The other counties would have to be a total of about $1.1 million to make up the deficit in 2009. In 2010, if that was the final cost, and we came up with no new revenues or anything, we'd have to be closer to $1.9 million. So that's what got me concerned long term, that even though we have cash balance, even though we have time to deal with this, that we should probably, if we have a chance, to change our operating levy to levy more for Lakeview to give us a little bit more time. And that's the point of all these slides, is not to get bogged down in any of the individual numbers, not to panic about any of the individual direction that we're going, because we have partners that want to be there with us, that want the services that we provide, and to just recognize that the sooner we make the decision to have a slightly larger levy than what I've got in the proposed budget would actually protect us longer term because it's not as much to make up. So instead of this kind of a graph that reflects actually up through 2009 what you've actually levied for Lakeview and the proposed levy, whoops, why doesn't that? It's out of order. Yeah, darn.
It worked better at exact, didn't it? I worked better at exact.
You see that the recommended levy for Lakeview under the proposed alternative goes back to $1.7 million. It still saves us money this year. All this financial work that we've been doing and the rates and relying on the cash balance still reduces the levy from this year at $1.9 million to $1.772 million. It just doesn't drop it as much and gives us a little bit more time to work the things out.
This, of course, is the slide that we talked about the other night, dealing with the highway budget. The ongoing issues that we've got that we've used money to help get us through 2007, 2008, 2009, and 2010. And this is where I said, what if we did something different than just relied on all of the million-dollar old landfill and save some of that and use some of the other choices? So let me get into... We've talked about the ongoing highway needs. I'm not going to go into that unless you've got questions about that for myself or Denny. But again, the ongoing challenge, which is to get us through this period of time where our levy has gone up to pay for the first part of the LEC debt, and next year is the last time it basically has to climb. It's basically level then, relatively speaking, from 2011 through 2014 until this blue part, as opposed to the purple or magenta, gets paid off. That it represents. Those blue bars represent the old LEC. The red parts represent the new LEC. What we're trying to do in this use of stimulus dollars and the other things that I'll talk about in a moment is get us through those 4 years until we save $1 million in debt service because we've paid off the old LEC. And what happens is actually two declines because they're in two separate bond issues, one that we already refinanced and one we can still probably refinance with a little bit of interest savings, but that was part of what we did last year. You see a big drop of about $1 million there and another million because by 2016, you've paid off the entire 1997 LEC. So what we're trying to do is figure out a way without raising taxes to do it, to spread out
use of bonding to get us through this period of time. So here's the opportunities and alternatives. Remember, I talked about how in the federal stimulus dollars, they did not give us a lot of grant help. They didn't fund road projects. Denny talked about that. We've got some in La Crosse County. City of Onalaska got Oak and a number of things. But we didn't get any direct funding. However, what we did get, federal government has allocated one-time, very low-cost bonding authority under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act called Stimulus of $1.6 million. It's a one-time bonding authority that we have. If we don't use it, it goes back to the pool, and they'll allocate it to someone else. It's estimated that if we do only a five-year note, it's a 45% decrease in the actual cost of the interest. The federal government's allowing us to borrow money and get a discounted rate on that. If we borrow for only a five-year note, it will be probably about 2%, maybe a little less. That's our best estimate right now from our financial advisors. Using that stimulus money then can help us make these other changes. The highway fund balance, and I'll talk about that in a moment, is strong and could service the debt payments for the next several years. What that allows us to do is rather than going to the well and using all of that highway fund balance for one-time road project, it allows us to spread the cost over the next several years and each year revisit this decision for new road projects. And that it allows us to use the strength that that highway fund balance has to not raise property taxes to make a debt payment while we've got to maintain this high debt payment for the law enforcement center. And third, using debt payments spread out over less than the life of the roads, 5 years, paid for by the highway fund balance, preserves the options during the LEC debt service situation and uses that ERA allocation to make that happen. The effect then, and why I've pointed this out, is the highway undesignated fund balance is actually at one of the strongest positions it's been at in recent memory. From 2005 to 2008, partly because of things like FEMA work being repaid, things like oil prices not being as high. In fact, we were hoping that 2009 might actually gain a little bit more to that. So in our policy, in your financial policies for non-general fund, is to keep the fund balance in the neighborhood of 20 to 30%. Now, rather than just swallowing up and using that all in 1 year, spreading this out under the strategy and taking advantage of the stimulus borrowing authority puts us in a position that we can revisit these assumptions each year and make sure that we're incurring as little interest as possible and spreading out the cost over that period of time and making sure not to harm highway. The other piece that we end up doing is that by taking the $1.6 million of borrowing authority plus the $500,000, only half of the old landfill property tax dollars, we save that $500,000 for next year. So again, we're not using every strategy in this year. We're spreading that out over the next couple of years. So the budget alternative is one, to use the $1.6 million of bonds plus half of the old landfill funds that we still have available for county roads and save the $500,000 for next year, because we're still going to have to do roads next year. Please. Work. We borrow in late 2010 and make a small payment in 2011, so we don't have any debt service in 2010's budget. By borrowing late in 2010, we won't incur a lot of interest. We make a small payment in 2011 and then four equal payments after that. That gets us to the end of the window of the LEC debt. Because it's only 2%, we'll only incur about $30,000 worth of interest on that. And guess what? Where are we investing the highway fund balance? We're probably only making about 2% most of the time anyway. So pay it as interest or gain it as interest, it's about the same. But it's getting us through this period of time where we're paying for two law enforcement centers. We then would reduce our operating levy, which is on the yellow page in your budget book. It's at the back there where it talks about operating levy and percentage. Instead of going up in operating levy by 3%, which is what that says in that back portion, in that gray bar where you see operating levy and the far right column says 3% operating levy, remember that. Instead of going up at all, only keep it flat, keep it zero. The rate goes from 317 then, instead of in the book, down to 308, and the total tax levy only goes up 2.66% instead of my proposed budget as presented of 5.19. So using the ERA money and using the borrowing strategy, we end up lowering the levy lower than what I've presented so far. We lower the highway levy by $1.1 million because we're using the borrowed funds to actually do the same amount of work. So it's not changing gross spending. It's actually using the borrowed funds from the stimulus package to pay for the highways for that year. And then we're able to increase the Lakeview levy back up to $1.7 million compared to, as I showed you on the bar graph, $1.9 million. It's closer to the MVHS rate. It gives us time to hopefully control that MVHS rate and not have to go to 60. If we can work with the other counties and get closer to 50 this year and then next year have longer-term solutions, it hedges our bet just a little bit, but we're not having to do a lot of catch-up in the following year. And each year we need to review our borrowing strategy for highway and other capital needs, and back to Supervisor Bina's questions and Supervisor Ebert's questions, what's happening with the building, what are the decisions we need to make. It gives us another 12 months as we evaluate how serious the other counties are in staying in the commitment. If we do serious capital investments there, it would be my proposal that they be a part of that, that it not just be tied into the rate, that if we're going to borrow dollars that are significant at Lakeview, that they be a partner long-term, not just within the rate. But that's a discussion we need to have and we'll have over the next 12 months with those folks. So in essence and in summary, using this strategy, we access money that the federal government has allocated to us to give ourselves some time and preserve the majority of the highway fund balance into the future. It preserves the majority or half of the old landfill dollars and allows us to keep evaluating this as we go each year into the future and really have a serious discussion with the board about what are the priorities in roads, what are the levels that we're falling behind on, but it gives us more time as we evaluate that. So, and this is how the actual debt structure works out. I just described that a minute ago. If you take the $1.6 million in borrowing authority plus the $500K in old landfill, that gives you $2.1 million, which is the current capital improvement plan for 2010's budget. As I said, if you borrow the late 2010, your first payment in 2011 would be $108,000, which is a small amount of principal and the interest that was incurred. And then in 12, 13, 14, at the end of 14, of course, your LEC drops off. So you can start to catch that up not just from fund balance. And each year you evaluate how you're doing this, and you also then, by the way, have closed out your law enforcement center. How did we time that bonding? How did we time those interest payments? So you'll come back in here, but we can get through this next 4 or 5 years without raising debt taxes to do that. In summary, what you end up getting to, if this thing will ever work, you punch that ahead. yeah, down button. In essence, we're comparing that we are not seeing short-term or long-term borrowing rates that are as low as we can borrow. Those first two bars talk about usually short-term money is around 3%. Usually long-term money is around 4.5%. The ERA or stimulus money allows us to take advantage of some very low interest rates. Our investment return right now on highway funds just invested in the market is probably around 2% or less. Inflation is usually growing at a much faster rate for just the cost of building roads than any of those figures. I hesitate to make a guess on what inflation is on the cost of labor, materials, those kinds of things to actually build roads, but they certainly exceed the lower numbers that are there. I showed you that on Lakeview. This summarizes, this was the first slide that you saw, which is that the total increase in property tax levy under the administrator's proposed budget without the alternative is $1,465,000. It goes from $28.2 million to $29.68 million. If you adopt the alternative, if the executive committee or there's a motion from the floor as we're finishing up budget adopts the alternative, this is where the change happens, is mainly in the highway levy reduction and the Lakeview levy reduction. So it only goes up $750,000 and doesn't raise taxes to pay that debt. It uses the highway fund balance to pay that. So that finally what happens is instead of a 5.19% increase, it would be a 2.6% increase in 2010, the lowest increase that we've been able to consider in the past 10 years. And then we get to what actually is part of the good part, which is it also preserves our options as we deal with this unfair rate freeze that we're one of the only counties in the state that's confronted with this. If the equalized value levels off or drops, we will end up having even more difficulty. So on the proposed side is what I've already given you. The tax rate would go up from 373 to 383 because the levy increase of 5% is more than the equalized value growth of 2.3. The alternative is that the tax rate would almost go up almost nothing, just negligible, from 373 to 374 because the levy increase of 2.6 is almost equal to the value growth. So your operating levy, which is the part that the rate freeze will impact, is 308. That means it kind of levels off our rate. That's different than the last graph that you had at the September policy planning meeting. But here's the choice that you have next year then. If we adopt the alternative, you're not as pushed up against the wall on making tough decisions. On the left-hand side is if you adopt the administrator's budget, which was the best I could do without the alternative, if equalized value rises 2% and levy rises, you're still under your rate limit of 324. If equalized value is zero and you raise your levy, which the levy limit law will let us do, by 3%, you're at your rate freeze limit right there. The bottom line is if the equalized value declines next year and we don't change this operating rate, you will have to end up having a complete levy freeze with no relief of any mandate or cost. On the right-hand side, if the alternative is 308, and equalized value, I'll just cut to the chase, declines by 2% and the levy goes up 3%, you only then have hit your rate freeze. We still believe, and I've talked to our representatives, I've talked to other administrators across the state, I still believe we need to get some modification. Most that I've talked to so far didn't even realize that there are two limits, a 3% levy limit plus a rate freeze. Of the eight counties that are confronted with this next year, I'll just go on a bandwagon. We have the lowest tax rate, the lowest per capita taxes, the lowest amount of spending of any of those eight counties by far. Not adjusted per capita, not anything, but by far. And yet we are impacted by this. And really what it comes out of is their own ability to control it, the state was tied into that we were one of the earliest ones to adopt the sales tax, so they froze our rate then. Nobody expected to see equalized value kind of be in this position. So I think we've got an opportunity to change that, but I don't want to count on that. So in summary, then, the last slide that I've got, and then I'll try to respond to questions, is that if you go ahead with the alternative or something close to it, the tax levy would increase by 2.66%, or the lowest that we've been able to do in 10 years. The tax rate would go up only 1 cent, or about 0.01%, and the impact on that average home of $150,000 instead of $15 as proposed per year would be about $7.50, and it preserves options for Lakeview and puts us in a better position there. It preserves options for Highway and at least puts us in a position that we've got more resources into the future. It helps to bridge the gap without raising debt taxes as we're paying off the first law enforcement center, and puts us in a better long-term position to really meet the needs of the community.
On October 27th at 3 o'clock, the executive committee is going to be having a budget meeting. It'll be talking about this issue and other budget-related issues. I'd certainly encourage any board members who are available at that time to attend. Again, that's Tuesday the 27th at 3 o'clock. But in the meantime, I think that the executive committee would also be interested in hearing any comments that the board has with regard to Steve's proposal of the alternative budget versus his original proposal versus whatever else. Mr. Bina.
Just a couple of questions. Okay, the stimulus money is, we're required to pay down the existing debt. You can't put new debt into that $1.6 million that you were planning on getting.
No, the $1.6 million is new borrowing authority for a new purpose, and it has to be for a public purpose. Later on your agenda is one of the initial requirements to be able to access that money. It doesn't commit you. Is a resolution establishing La Crosse County as a recovery zone. It has to be for new bonding. It has to be for a new project. It can't go towards the old law enforcement center, for example. So that 1.6 would be borrowed for a portion of our county road projects next year under this proposal. So it's new projects, new borrowing.
But your graphs were showing that you're extending out the payment schedule of the jail, and that's old debt.
That's independent of this decision.
It is.
Maybe we can go back to that graph.
Okay, you lost me then someplace.
Yep. Go back to about like the... What I'm showing you, regardless of any budget decision you make, if you go back far enough, just a few more, it's to the purple and blue. This is an important thing because I want to... keep going back. Go. Sorry. Again, bear with me because this is a... And I think... Keep going. I'm sorry. I really... This. That's it. This is regardless of what you do on budget right now. This is what you're committed, this community already, to this kind of debt. You've already sold the debt. These are the schedule of the payments that are going to be. If you never do anything that I just talked about in the alternative, this is your debt payment. The blue is the debt payment for the 1997 law enforcement. The purple or magenta or whatever you want to call it is the increases in debt. All I'm suggesting is that we use stimulus money to fund roads through a borrowing and make those payments not with this money, because we've already committed that. We make the payments with the highway fund balance so that we don't raise debt taxes to do it, and that we use it over time rather than just swallowing up and making it for one road project. That we spread that out, because what we're trying to do is get to the point where you have some debt room that you can return that to your operating levy. Once that drops off, you either do the campus plan, you don't do anything to this building, but you have room. Remember when I first started recognizing what was happening to your equalized value, I said we can't take on the campus plan right now.
Okay.
And we also can't take on a huge amount of new debt for roads. We've got a challenge and a responsibility, I believe, to the public that we've made this investment as our highest priority. Let's control debt taxes for a long period of time. And we've got to get to that point through, I believe, 2015 and 2016.
Okay.
And so we're trying to do this by using the best management of our reserves to make debt payments instead of raising taxes to do it, and to use the new stimulus bonding authority, which is very low interest, to make that happen.
And what would be the maximum you could consider with the stimulus money?
$1.6 million.
Only based on your suggestion that now.
The authority we got, Don.
Well, that's the maximum.
That's all we got.
That's what I'm asking.
That's all we got.
That's the maximum authority we have available to us.
Right.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
Right.
I thought maybe
this is a one-time thing,
and
then we've got to deal with this again next year.
Right.
But it gives us some breathing room next year.
Okay. Any other questions, Jeff Schrader?
Thank you. The scenario you painted there just carries out 4 years or 2 years.
It carries us on that road project actually through the fifth year, which is 2015, which is the final payment.
But the stimulus money was only going to be used for 2 years, is that right?
No, the stimulus money is used all for this year, $1.6 million, along with $500,000 of the old landfill, so you get $2.1 million that does the road projects we've got budgeted for. And then next year you've got to relook at what are the interest costs for 2011, What amount of road projects you want to do. You look for short-term money. You try to do the same thing next year.
Thank you.
And then the next year. And until you can get to the point of 2014 and 2015 where that starts to drop off. But we've done enough long-term projections that we believe by managing this, you will have a positive decision without having to raise taxes to do this for the next 4 years. But you will make that decision each year at a time as we verify all of those numbers as we go through.
Ray Ebert.
Thank you, sir. What effect is the prevailing wage thing going to do on our highways? Are we going to lose substantial?
Town
board brought it up last night and what it was going to do.
I'm not an expert in this. Denny and Jim Spropolis have talked about the effects of prevailing wage. So.
Well, effective January of 2010, there's a $25,000 limit on projects. Over that amount, then prevailing wage must be paid. So some of the different activities, truck drivers and things like that, right now we're pretty close, and in fact over on some of them, but some of the operating positions, it could be up to $7 per hour increase for some of the different type positions. So.
If you could do just a wild ass or guess, I guess I can say the other part I shouldn't have. What is it going to be? Are we going to be able to do 5% less or 10% less, you know, building roads?
On our projects alone, anything we do for ourselves, that doesn't come into effect. It's if we want to do work for another municipality. So it's when we would, if a township wanted to do some paving, we would have to figure in the prevailing wage rates versus what the employees are being paid now. But if we do our own work, we're exempt from that. We don't have to pay the prevailing wage there. We pay the union wage.
And if we are contracting out, we're paying the prevailing wage anyway, so it doesn't matter? If we're contracting to Scott or someone to do something, we're already paying that prevailing wage?
I'm missing your point there.
Do we ever contract out work, or do we do it all ourselves?
We do all of our own work.
Oh, okay, we never okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Joe Bilskemper.
The prevailing wage then would, if we do, we contract for another municipality?
Another township, or if we...
Okay, we're paying their prevailing wage.
Oh, it's set by the state.
It's set by the state.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Jared Johnson.
How far off of prevailing wage are we right now?
Like I say, some positions like truck drivers with our fringes and everything, we're at or a little bit above, but looking through the list... as of right now, like a backhoe operator, we'd have to pay like $7 an hour more for that backhoe operator. It doesn't really make sense. The flagman gets more per hour than the guy driving some of the big trucks or big equipment. So,
is coming from the state, and it doesn't make sense to you, Denny?
Joe Bilskemper.
How much work are we actually contracting out this way, at percentage-wise, of work that we do just for the county, as opposed to we do for example, the town of Greenfield? How much percentage? Just a round ballpark figure.
Well, for the city of Onalaska, we did about 200,000 in seal coating. But
no, I mean percentage-wise, total. Is this going to be enough to even?
We just won't be able to compete on that. It'll be done by the private contractors. So. We'll mainly be working just on our system, doing our own work, and any paving or anything like that, we won't be able to compete, so it'll be done by contractors. So.
Ralph Geary.
Denny, I think the question was if the municipalities that we're contracting with have a project over $25,000, if they hire a private contractor, they have to pay that contractor prevailing rate.
That's correct.
So then... why aren't we competitive if we have to pay prevailing rate?
Because we got to buy the materials from the contractor. We don't have our own hot mix plant or things like that. So
you mean Massey?
Right, or we buy the gravel. We don't, or the base course. We don't have our own supply. We pay the middleman. So, or the supplier.
Well, the suppliers usually are the contractors also.
Right, but if you own the business where the product's being produced, they got an up. I mean, that's their product where we got to buy it from them. There's an upcharge, so it's hard to compete. It's just going to make it more difficult. Do we do a lot of it after the asphalt prices and things went sky high? No, we haven't. Fortunately, they consider seal coating maintenance yet, so that's not doesn't come under the prevailing wage rule, so... we do a fair amount of seal coating, like I say, for the city of Onalaska. We do some
for the city of La Crosse occasionally in 3-4 townships. As far as paving, after the asphalt went way out of sight, we haven't been able to compete. So,
Marilyn Pedretti.
I guess a follow-up to that, because the town of Holland has used the county, and it's been a wonderful service. We're probably have to hire out on some things. And I tried to allude to it last time when I asked the question, are you going to have to lay off workers this summer because there won't be enough work for the county?
No, we got the work there, and the work is out there. So.
Okay, that won't be an issue.
We do. We try to take on extra if we can to fill in some gaps, but then we got the work that if we don't get the extra from the townships, there's other activities that we take care of, the lesser things that we have the time then to pay attention to those activities.
I do know that at a towns meeting we're at, we can still use the county if the bids come in higher than anticipated by a town, as a town would set a rate in a closed session, and if the bids come in high, we could still use it. So there is still a possibility.
But still prevailing wage comes into effect.
You
what you're talking about is the TRIP program, and the only
right.
way the counties can do the work
is
if bids come in 10% higher than the estimate that the township sets, then they can come to the county and ask for a quotation.
Okay. And so I guess then just a final that on top of that, if the county did it, and you say, like, your backhoe operator would have to get $7 more, so then you bid that in, does that operator get it just for that job, or does that operator get a raise?
It's just for that specific
that job. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any observations on original proposal versus alternative? Anybody want to weigh in on that, or you want to wait till we get to the budget stuff in November? Okay. Apparently people are going to wait. All righty. That it for you then, Mr. O'Malley? Okay, cards and correspondence are over on the board there. No committee meetings during recess. We have appointments. Tara, if you can take the chair.
Chairman Doyle.
Thank you. I have three appointments. Robert Kyle for the Commission on Aging, Jeff Schrader for the Aviation Board, and Marilyn Pedretti for Winding River's Library System.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Supervisor Sobranek. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carries unanimously.
Thank you.
Item 6-10, Consent Agenda. Is there a motion on that? Supervisor Plesha, seconded by Supervisor Sobranek. Discussion on Consent Agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carries unanimously. Item 10-10, Executive Committee. Supervisor Veenstra, if you could take that, please.
Sorry.
This will be a second reading of this ordinance.
Thanks. Consideration of item 10-10, the cost upon frivolous complaints ordinance, an ordinance to create section 2.04.10b11 of chapter 2 of the Code of Ethics of the Code of La Crosse County regarding cost upon frivolous complaints.
Moved by Supervisor Veenstra, the ordinance on frivolous complaints. Is there a second? Seconded by Supervisor Richmond. Discussion, Chairman Doyle.
Thank you. Last month at the first reading, a question was asked about what prompted this ordinance, or was there some event that came up or some reason why we needed it. And what I thought would probably be the most helpful thing for me to do this evening is to give a demonstration. And the ironic thing about the question last month about why we need it is the person who asked that question, that being Mr. Schrader. Mr. Schrader, do you know what I'm holding in my hand?
No.
I'll get close. All right, now, you call this an apple. I call this evidence. All right? Do Do you recall about a month ago, Wisconsin Counties Association had its convention here in La Crosse? Okay, and do you recall making a fairly substantial purchase in convention in conjunction with that event?
What number are you?
I think we have a hostile witness here. Do you recall purchasing some apples?
I do.
You do? Okay. How many did you buy?
Supervisor Schrader, could you just go back to your microphone, please, so we can all laugh along?
No.
Please.
Did I volunteer for this?
You were drafted.
Ah, okay. Now, what was your question again, sir?
How many apples did you buy?
That's a good question.
Thank you. Do I recall correctly that it was three pecks?
Three pecks.
And the difference between a peck and a bushel?
I have no idea. That's just what you would, just what you had told me.
So then you expect me to answer that.
Okay. You bought a substantial amount of apples. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
When you bought those apples, did you tell the store owner that you were a county board member?
I don't believe so.
Did you ask for a discount?
Did I ask? I did not ask for a discount.
Did you tell people that you received a discount for purchasing those apples? In fact, did you tell people that you paid half price for those apples? In fact, did you tell fellow board members, and actually fellow board members from across the state, that you paid half price, meaning that you got a $70 discount for buying some apples because you told them that you were a county board member and the Wisconsin Counties Association had its convention here in La Crosse?
I'm going to correct you there because I told them we were having a county Wisconsin Counties Association meeting, and I did not tell them I was a county board supervisor.
Okay, so you indicated that there were some elected officials coming to town. All right. Now, if you had indicated to them, I'm Jeff Schrader, private citizen, and I've got a bunch of friends coming over to watch the game tonight, you think you would have gotten the same discount?
I believe I would have gotten the discount for any organization that was bringing possible exposure to his business.
But you told them that a bunch of elected officials were coming to town.
I did not.
No, you just said that a minute ago you
did. I said
okay.
Wisconsin
right.
Counties Association.
Okay, Wisconsin Counties Association. While you were there, did anybody else get any half-price deals on purchases that they made that you noticed?
I have no idea.
Okay. This discount that you got, did you pay that with your own money or did you use a county check?
I believe it was on my credit card.
Okay. And you had not talked to me ahead of time in terms of authorizing county expenditure for that purpose, right?
That's correct.
So the deal...
Is this hypothetical?
This is a hypothetical, Mr. Menninger.
Give me
time.
Well, I'm going to give him a little latitude. I think he's coming close to making his point. But thank you for the reminder, Supervisor Menninger.
So.
No, I'm not. I'm glad somebody else recognized.
Okay. Now, Mr. Schrader, you are aware that we have a county ethics code. And I assume, right? Right? You're aware that we have a county ethics code?
I'm not answering.
Okay. That's probably smart. It's probably smart. Okay, well, let me read part of the county ethics code. Section 2.04, parent 8, parent A reads in part as follows: an official or employee shall not solicit or accept anything of value, whether in the form of a gift, service, loan, or promise from any person which may impair independence of judgment or action in the performance of official duties. And importantly, nor shall an official or employee accept from any person or organization directly or indirectly preferential treatment of anything of value without full payment. Okay? It also then later on says, if the ethics board determines that an official or employee has violated any provision of this code, the ethics board may, as part of its report to the county board, make any of the following recommendations. Number one, in the case of an official who is an elected county board supervisor, that the county board consider sanctioning, censuring, or removing the person. You, I assume, would agree that that code applies to all of us here, right?
He's not answering.
Good move. Now I want to go back a little further in time. Do you recall 24 months and 3 weeks ago, at the county budget hearing, you voted to reduce the pay of the county board chair? Uh-huh. I remember that very distinctly. Okay, and it's taken 2 years, but here's my chance to file an ethics complaint against you, Mr. Schrader. All right? Now, let's talk about where we're at. You're in a whole three pecks of trouble today. Because it gets worse than the ethics complaint. If you lose this ethics complaint, then the district attorney would likely file criminal charges against you because the offense that I've alleged would also be considered graft and misconduct in public office. Those would be felonies, as in prison. Now, Mr. Schrader, where did you get those apples?
Mr. Doyle, is this being recorded?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, then, turn it off. If this is hypothetical, turn the whole thing off.
This is hypothetical, and you'll see why. You'll see why.
No, there's people watching that will be watching this that won't know that.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's not guilty.
No.
He's not guilty. I'm trying to make a point how people can twist things. All right? Now, Mr. Schrader, I understand that you got those apples from Bowers, which is in La Crescent, which is across state lines. So are we talking federal offenses here now, too? All right, so that's the situation that we have if I wanted to come after you and try to get some sort of revenge against you. All right? So now, with that that you're up against, you probably want a good attorney. So we all know our former colleague, Keith Belzer, very good attorney, familiar with county ordinances. So you may want to go to him. Well, he's going to charge you probably $5,000, $10,000 because if you lose that ethics complaint, you could be looking at really serious charges. So you've got to take this seriously. Even though I assume everybody here tonight figures this is pretty off the wall. Okay? But that's the situation that a person could find himself in. So here's what could happen. Under the current ordinance, if I filed this complaint against you and you maintain your innocence or even prove your innocence before this case is even heard, it doesn't make any difference. Still goes forward. If you lose the case, you could lose your seat. I win. You win the case, you don't get your attorney fees back. I still won. If you convince the board that I was unfair and came up with an off-the-wall accusation against you, and you convince them to reimburse you for your attorney fees, the taxpayers lose. That's the concern that I have in this situation. Now, I put together this proposed ordinance basically in conjunction with looking at how can we deal with a situation where somebody comes up with something that is so off the wall, which is what this allegation would be. If we come up with something that is so off the wall, how can a person be protected who didn't do anything wrong and who clearly didn't do anything wrong? And so I went to Bill Shepard and I said, Bill, I want you to come up with a proposal that will deal with that, but that does not have a chilling effect of people who have a legitimate concern not being able to bring it forward. And so I asked Bill to take a look at our ordinance and excuse me, see what he could come up with in terms of some sort of a mechanism to pull out the off-the-wall complaints. Now, Bill, I didn't let you in on the details of this demonstration. I want you, though, to turn to 2.04 paren 8 of the County Ethics Code. Bill, if you've got it there. While you're looking for it, I'm going to read the first part of it again. An official or employee shall not solicit or accept anything of value, whether in the form of a gift, service, loan, or promise from any person, which may impair independence of judgment or action in the performance of official duties. Nor shall an official or employee accept from any person or organization, directly or indirectly, preferential treatment or anything of value without full payment. Okay? As far as I have read in that ordinance bill, would you agree that I could perhaps make a plausible argument that Mr. Schrader did something wrong, as far as I read in that ordinance?
Yeah, there's one.
Can you use your mic, Bill, please?
Just up to the point that I read.
Yes.
Okay. But I didn't read the whole thing, did I?
No.
Okay. Read what comes next.
The, okay, I'm not sure where you left.
Well, it continues. If it could be reasonably expected to influence a vote, a contract, or reasonably be considered as a reward for any governmental action or inaction, there is no way I could win on that claim. Jeff did not do anything wrong. He did something good. I took an ordinance and twisted it and made a good thing look bad. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about in this situation that would be wrong. Jeff did a very good thing, and thank you for somewhat playing along with this. But I wanted to make the point that that can happen to any of us here. Somebody doesn't like something that we did, and it might even be one of us doesn't like something that one of us did. We can find a way to get you. And when I asked Bill to take a look at this, I was looking for the harassment, the revenge kind of thing, not the borderline cases. You know, people have asked, well, you know, was this motivated by that one across the street there, the city complaint? And I have never read the city's ethics code. I didn't read that complaint. I have no idea if that was a frivolous complaint. But for the first time ever, the city ended up paying $10,000 or some amount of money in dealing with a complaint. Could that happen here? I hope not. I hope that never happens here. But for the first time over at the city, they had an expensive one. We have had ethics issues raised before. To my knowledge, none have ever been successful. To my knowledge, none of them I would call frivolous. I think that we saw some of them as they came in and said, you know, just in our own personal view looking at it, probably not going to be successful, but that's not what this is about. This is an amendment to our ordinance for the off-the-wall one type of a complaint against a county official that is so clearly off the wall that it has no merit whatsoever. And so, Bill, can you explain what would happen as we stand today, if I had filed that complaint against Mr. Schrader, what could happen at this point with the amendment in place?
Okay. Just a preface to that. My mic is on. I'm sorry. I'm probably not sitting close enough. This ordinance didn't just come out of thin air, and I think I've mentioned this to the executive committee. This ordinance is really modeled after state statutes and federal rules. So there is a basis for this. It's a rule that our state courts enforce when there is a frivolous claim, and also federal courts. And I look at recent court decisions. We get them every week. And most attorneys probably do, to see what cases have come up recently that are of interest. And within the last couple months, there are two cases where the Court of Appeals has levied costs for frivolous complaints. And also the federal court, and the article is in today's Milwaukee Journal, regardless of your political persuasion, there is a woman that filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging President Obama's citizenship. The federal court found that to be frivolous, and I'm sure that they use the rule that we've modeled this or our ordinance after and fined her $20,000. So again, it's based on some law, not just something that comes out of the blue. But in answer to Steve's question, there are two ways that this issue could be raised. Initially, it could be raised by motion of the accused. So the accused has an ability to raise the issue that the complaint against him or her is frivolous by filing or drafting a motion, serving it on the party bringing the complaint. And the purpose of this is to provide a safe harbor, a 21-day period in which the person that's bringing the accusation has 21 days to consider that the other party feels that the case is frivolous. And so they can decide to withdraw their entire complaint. If it's perhaps just one allegation out of several, they could dismiss that particular allegation. If they choose not to dismiss within that safe harbor period, then the person bringing the motion after 21 days has a right to file that with the Ethics Board and be heard on that motion in and of itself. And that is identical to the state and federal rule. So that, I think, both the state and feds consider this to be, quote, a stop-and-think rule, giving the accuser an opportunity to think about whether or not what they're bringing forward is, in fact, based on law or facts that can be proven. And if they don't stop and think, and it's found to be frivolous, then in our case, the Ethics Board could sanction them by imposing costs that are incurred by the other party, the attorney's fees, would be primarily those costs. The second way, and Mr. Schrader, if you...
Do you have a question of Mr. Shepard, Supervisor Schrader?
Yes. Can the Ethics Board levy... Can they levy a fine or whatever you want to call it? Do they have the authority to do that?
I think that the creation of an ethics court is authorized by state statute. The state statute doesn't say, you know, how you do it or what you include. So I think you have as a county board the authority to enact an ethics code. Now, certainly. The Ethics Board can't abuse their authority, and if they do sanction a party, it would be appealable, and frankly, that's how many of these cases come to the attention of the court. An allegation is made that the court, a lower circuit court, has exceeded their discretion challenge that in a court of appeals. So they could bring an action in circuit court in this case from the decision of the Ethics Board, in my opinion. So that would be available to them.
But the important thing is that this would be an extraordinary remedy. This would only be for the totally off-the-wall cases. I mean, the law uses the term frivolous, and that has a specific legal meaning. Just because somebody brings an ethics complaint and loses, the court finds that there was not, or the Ethics Board finds there was not any unethical behavior, doesn't mean that they're going to get stuck with any costs. Only if they were basically warned ahead of time that this is baseless, that would be the only time. And it would still be discretionary. They wouldn't have to impose sanctions. They could decide, well, it was frivolous, but we're not going to impose any sanctions.
Chairman Doyle, has Mr. Shepard read all that you want him to read?
Bill, did you say something about a second thing then?
Well, the second way that the sanction can be imposed is basically by the Ethics Board, and the ordinance explains how that is done. The Ethics Board can give notice to the other party by what we call an order to show cause, that the Ethics Board believes that the complaint is is frivolous, gives through an order to show cause, gives the party an opportunity to be heard, and could levy, you know, the sanctions based on their own accord. But one of the provisions in the state and federal law is that this order to show cause would have to be filed by the ethics board prior to the settlement of the case. So, and there's a lot of discussion. Somebody doesn't want to settle a case and then after that have the ethics board bring an order to sanction them further. So it gives some discretion on the part of the ethics board to take action on their own initiative if they choose to do so. More likely it would be brought by a
The
motion.
Ordinance is on the floor, Supervisor Mettinger, and Chairman Doyle is done, and Supervisor Paff has asked to speak.
I have no problem.
Supervisor Paff.
I have one question, and that was to Mr. Shepard. When you you said that this here would they had 21 days to think it over before it went forward. But does that keep it out of the public during those 21 days, or does a person with a frivolous lawsuit already proved his point by making defamation of character more, so to speak, of the person by putting it, you know, in the public, and then that leaves the question in the public's mind, well, maybe there was something to this, or it would, in my position, it would make defamation against me if Mr. Doyle brought such a thing against me, but then he did pull it 21 days later. Within the 21-day period, he pulled it. But the damage is done to me. So in this here, what you have here, I think that should be in there, that it cannot be made public until after 21 days.
That exists in the current ordinance, though. Well, and
okay, but I don't agree with that. I think the
open records law.
Is done. The damage is done.
I'm looking at the media representatives in the room. I can't imagine that there's much that would be kept.
If I could.
Mr. Shepard.
Well, the person has the ability that wants to file an ethics claim to file that with the county clerk, and that's probably going to be open to the public. The motion alleging that this accusation is frivolous is not to be filed with the ethics board for that 21 days, giving that accuser a 21-day time to stop and think about it. That is the federal and state law, and that's what this is modeled after.
Are there other supervisors who have stopped and thought longer than Chairman Doyle about what they want to say, who want to speak on this issue? Supervisor Ebert.
Thank you. Mr. Shepard, you talked about it after a state and federal, but are those bodies, considering they're judicial bodies as opposed to an ethics who is not really, I wouldn't think that's certainly a quasi-judicial at best, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
So it would, I mean, to say because it's based on the federal and state, again, they are truly judicial in nature.
That is true.
And the other one was, thank you, sir.
Supervisor Meyer.
Steve, I can remember one example early in your time here and early in my time and some of the other older supervisors had to do with pricing an air conditioner. Turned out to be frivolous and nothing ever happened to it. I'm not using names, and I'm sure you probably remember now.
So everybody will rush home to their history books and
talk to
Don afterward, Supervisor Meyer afterward. Supervisor Friedland.
I want to make a statement as an unappreciated longtime legal aid lawyer from my own years of experience. I know that people who come before a tribunal often have an incomplete or unsophisticated knowledge of how the legal system works. Often they can't find a lawyer, and unrepresented clients often take longer in their cases, and sometimes they don't seem to ever go away. Litigants and attorneys who represent the underdog often irritate and aggravate, and they present unpopular arguments. But when the county services that citizens want are limited or even, in their view, withheld by public officials, be it for their safety, be it their public benefits or health services, anger and frustration isn't unexpected by these citizens. If a case is doesn't have any grounds, if it's groundless, it ought to be dismissed. I think that in the hypothetical that you're giving, it would have been dismissed early. I don't think it would have gotten to the point where a $5,000 attorney's fee would have been warranted. Maybe we need some kind of a mechanism in the ethics code for something like a summary judgment, which would be in a civil case where you can have a quick determination of whether the case has grounds or not grounds. But I think that the threat of penalty for a frivolous action could threaten or chill a fundamental principle of our nation, which is the right, even the invitation to address our government. We shouldn't create what citizens might see as barriers to whistleblowing, even where some bad apples or frivolous cases exist. I think we need to keep our ethics board accessible, and we even need to find ways to facilitate bringing improper conduct to light. And so I'm planning to vote against this for that those reasons.
Supervisor Bina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm kind of curious. You know, I've been here for 20 years, and I know we convened the ethics board a number of times. You know how many that was in the last 20 years? I know it was 3, 4.
I'm going to guess half a dozen.
Probably. That's what I'd say, too. How many attempts in, and you're an attorney and I'm not, but how many attempts at a frivolous one surfaced over those years? I don't remember very many of them.
Maybe Mr. Shepard.
There was discussion about different things at different times, but the question I have, I guess, is, you know, I thought our system was working pretty good the way it was, and believe it or not, I believe I agree with Maureen back here pretty soundly that unless something is broken, why do we need to fix it better than what we have already? And I'm not sure if this is for the betterment, because if somebody has a concern and they come to me as a supervisor and they don't like my explanation, I refer them to somebody at the office here someplace. We forego most of those frivolous things. So I'm not exactly sure we need this too badly.
Mr. Shepard, do you know the answer to the question about number of times that the ethics board has been convened and what the disposition has been of those issues? Your recollection?
Well, I know that they have never found unethical behavior. In all of the claims that they've had, they have never found in favor of the accuser.
Supervisor Veenstra.
Thank you. I was just curious about the interplay of the 21-day safe harbor with the timing of an actual hearing or preliminary hearing regarding the ethics complaint. I noticed that there were some dates later in the ordinance about 10 days notice to the accused and then 20 days notice to the accused of the actual hearing. And I wanted to make sure, I'm not saying that it needs to be amended now, but perhaps we should take a look at those and make sure the timing makes sense if somebody is going to an accused brings a motion and wants the needs the 21 days before the hearing, that they actually have the 21 days.
So, Mr. Shepard, you'll look at that.
Yeah, there may, you know, it could be that if the ethics board was notified that there was a pending motion, you know, they may have to delay the convening of the complaint to allow the 21 days to occur, but you know, you've made a good point, Mr. Veenstra.
I guess I'm a little concerned about an accused having to inform the board. I think the idea behind the safe harbor is that it's safe and that nobody hears about it except the accuser, and then the accuser can, if they, you know,
maybe they talk to somebody about it and they say, I thought this was unethical, and then they talk to somebody and then they say, really, no, this is totally frivolous, and they can withdraw it in peace and the board doesn't even have to hear about it, I guess.
Supervisor Sobranek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I understand about this ordinance is not whether somebody brings a frivolous charge or not. The item we're discussing is the cost. Could somebody explain the cost? That's actually what we're talking about, not whether somebody brings a suit or not. How does that affect it? Could I get some clarification on that?
Chairman Doyle.
Yes, I can address that. And I, at the same time, I'd like to also address Maureen Friedland's concern. There are three people on this county board who are attorneys. There are 32 who are not. If somebody files an ethics charge against any of the 35 people, that person who is accused of some unethical behavior may have to hire an attorney. Would it be $5,000? Not necessarily. Hopefully it would not be. But if a situation was serious enough, they may incur some expenses, hiring an attorney to defend themselves. I'm not talking about a person who brings a claim against the county. I'm talking about a person who brings a claim against you or you or you or you, that type of a situation, against an individual. Because you don't have the legal knowledge, most of you don't have the legal knowledge of how to defend yourself in a quasi-judicial type of a proceeding, and you may incur some expenses. The ethics board in that situation could say, Mr. Sobranek, you paid $500 for an attorney, and it was clearly non-meritorious, frivolous type of a claim against you. You shouldn't have had to pay that $500. Mr. or Ms. Accuser, you have to reimburse Mr. Sobranek his attorney fees. That's what I'm talking about here. That's the kind of situation.
Thank you, Chair Doyle.
Supervisor Burns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification, Mr. Doyle, are you the author of this ordinance, or
yes.
Is Mr. Shepard? Because
I asked him to draft it.
Okay, so Mr. Shepard drafted it, and then you looked at it, and
I said, Bill, here's the concerns I want you to address, and he came up with it, and I didn't have any changes because I thought he did a good job.
Okay, so Mr. Shepard, you said this is. There's other this state and federal statutes have provisions like this in other ethics codes?
Not in ethics codes. We're talking about state statutes that pertain to litigation.
Okay. Are there any other counties in the state of Wisconsin that have a provision like this in their ethics code?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And then you mentioned that this quasi-judicial ethics board has statutory authority to enforce these things.
No, what I said was the county board by statute has the authority to create an ethics code. It's pretty ambiguous as to it doesn't. The state statute doesn't say what the ethics code prohibit the.
So I guess what I'm trying to say then is this is like a this has never been done.
I don't know.
I mean,
it has been done in the federal or state and state court system, and also by there's a similar state statute that pertains to administrative hearings, which are quasi-judicial in answer to. To Mr. Ebert's concerns that they aren't administrative hearings by state hearing examiners also have a frivolous they also can levy costs for frivolous actions.
Okay, so you don't see that to be a concern then that whatever if this was to go into play this provision the ethics board you don't see that to be an issue. And be challenged by the courts and.
Well, I mean, it could be challenged, but there are all kinds of cases in both the state and federal court system in which frivolous costs have been levied, and so there's a lot of authority out there in the context of litigation, and so we're not treading on totally foreign ground. I mean, it's pretty well defined as to what, you know, what's frivolous and what isn't.
Okay. Thank you.
Supervisor Geary.
Thank you. Bill, under the current legal system, if we did nothing, what's the remedy for the individual?
For the accused?
Yes.
He has no remedy.
Well, can he sue the person for a frivolous complaint in civil court or?
No. You there's no remedy.
There's no remedy.
Supervisor Fisher.
I don't have a problem with this, except for it being in the open in the 21 days. And I agree with Supervisor Veenstra. There should be some way that it is just between the person accused and the person doing the accusation.
It isn't in the open. It isn't in the open. It isn't to be filed with the ethics board. That's the point, and it's again.
After the 21 days.
Only.
So what I'm getting to is that the person falsely accused doesn't get the same as what.
Okay.
Doesn't get accused and you know in the media for 21 days because the public doesn't.
Well.
You know, they make judgments that aren't appropriate. So you're saying for the 21 days. It is not going to be. I heard before.
It's a very good question. I think that there is some confusion. The complaint would be filed, and you know the accused can go to the media and say I filed this complaint. There's nothing that anybody can do to stop that. If the person making the complaint wants to go out and publicize that I've made that complaint, they can do that. They don't have to, and it may not come out in the open. The 21 days, the motion is not filed with the ethics board until the expiration of that period. During that period, the accused can have a discussion with the accuser and provide them with information or position statement as to why they think accusation is false and or is frivolous, so that wouldn't necessarily be out in the open. But if the accuser wants to say, you know, something to the contrary to the media, I guess that's their right of free speech. Yeah, it's just that they don't file it with the ethics board for that 21. Okay. It gives them a time to get it resolved. So,
Supervisor Conkle.
I would just like to say that I think you guys drafted overall a good ordinance, and I think that we've had adequate time to ask a lot of questions. So with that, I'd like to call the question.
The question has been called and seconded. All those in favor of ending debate signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Supervisor Ebert, Supervisor Friedland, Supervisor Geary, Supervisor Pedretti, Supervisor Veenstra all vote no on the motion to close debate. Debate has been closed. We're going to vote on the computer on this, please. So I'll switch places with you. All those in favor of the ordinance as presented, vote yes. All those opposed, vote no.
If you are in favor of the ordinance, vote yes. If you are opposed, vote no. Won't show up there, though. Well, you're going to have to trust me on this. It passed on a vote of 22-9. Right, Linda? I'm not just making it up. All right. And again, two things. I think Mr. Schrader did a very good thing, not any ethical consideration, and he did not vote to cut my pay 2 years ago. Mr. Ebert made the motion, and it didn't get a second, so I had no reason to go out to go after him. I should have gone after this guy instead, but I didn't.
I've already been beaten to death.
All right. 11-10, Tara Johnson.
A resolution to the honorable members of the La Crosse County Board of Supervisors regarding designating the County of La Crosse, Wisconsin as a countywide recovery zone. Whereas in order to assist state and local governments in financing capital projects at lower borrowing costs and to stimulate the economy and create jobs, on February 17, 2009, the Congress of the United States enacted the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And whereas pursuant to the Stimulus Act, recovery zone economic development bonds and recovery zone facility bonds must be issued by a state or local government pursuant to an allocation by the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States of America, hereafter known as the Secretary, of a portion of a nationwide volume limitation. And whereas in order to use such allocation and to issue recovery zone economic development bonds or recovery zone facility bonds, an issuer must first designate one or more recovery zones, and whereas the Secretary has awarded the county an allocation of $1.6 million for recovery zone economic development bonds and an allocation of $2.4 million for recovery zone facility bonds, and whereas the County Board has determined, in order to promote and protect the health, safety, morals, and welfare of the public in the county, that such recovery zone conditions need to be addressed. And whereas the county has evaluated various lawful available programs to provide such assistance, and whereas the officers and employees of the county who are responsible for planning and economic development studies and for making recommendations to the county board have advised the county board that the county as a whole qualifies as a recovery zone under the Stimulus Act as a result of significant poverty, significant unemployment, a significant rate of home foreclosures, and general distress in the county as a whole. And whereas the county board is generally informed and familiar with the conditions now extant in the county, now therefore be it resolved by the County Board of Supervisors of the County of La Crosse, Wisconsin, that the county board determines there exists conditions including significant poverty, significant unemployment, a significant rate of home foreclosures, and general distress within the county as a whole, which cause the county as a whole to be subject to designation as a recovery zone under the Stimulus Act, and La Crosse County as a whole is hereby designated as a recovery zone for all purposes of and as provided in the Stimulus Act. Section 3, if any section, paragraph, or provision of this ordinance shall be held to be invalid or unenforceable for any reason, the invalidity or unenforceability of such section, paragraph, or provision shall not affect any of the remaining provisions of this ordinance. And Section 4, all ordinances, resolutions, motions, or orders in conflict herewith be and the same hereby are superseded to the extent of such conflict, and this ordinance shall be in full force and effect immediately upon its passage by the County Board and approval as provided by law, without publication or posting or any further act or requirement. I move its approval.
Moved by Tara Johnson, second by Vicki Burke. Any discussion? Jeff Schrader.
What does that mean that... that
in like 20 words or less?
No, not in one word if you can answer it, but does that mean that we're going to borrow the 1.6?
Mr. O'Malley.
Gary worked directly with bond counsel on this. This just preserves our ability to access these for any project within La Crosse County that meets the standards. Remember, there's two authorities, $1.6 million, which is the one I talked about with public activity. If you choose not to do the roads issue that I talked about and you choose to use it for another purpose anywhere within La Crosse County, you can do that. If we don't adopt this, you can't have that as an option. If you adopt this resolution, you have not committed to the $1.6 million. You still have to make a separate decision on that. The second authority is $2.4 million. That's private activity. I've talked about that before. It's for one of the first times that counties can use what's like an industrial revenue bond for a private business activity. Doesn't incur our bonding authority, but gets lower interest for a business activity. All this does is say that somewhere in La Crosse County, this board could decide to allocate both of those. If we do nothing more than this resolution, both of those allocations go back to the pool and we never end up committing anything. This just means we don't have to designate a specific neighborhood for it. We don't have to designate a specific project for it. It says that we believe La Crosse County, under the statutory authority of the stimulus, says that we can use it for any of those two types of purposes. This preserves your authority. It doesn't restrict your authority.
Any other questions or discussion? Marilyn Pedretti.
I guess I'm confused because the first part where ours is a resolution that's now therefore is it keeps referring to an ordinance. And I'm sure it's just language. It's what you had to do with the federal government. But it doesn't make sense to me. And I was asking Joe, being a lawyer, why? What if you keep referring to an ordinance, section three. I don't get it. This is a resolution, not an ordinance. It was drafted by the federal government. This is what you have to use. You're combining two different things, a resolution and ordinance in one, and this is a resolution, no?
It's boilerplate language from the federal government.
Well, what ordinance are you referring to? Who knows, and who cares? Okay.
Yeah, you're right.
It's weird language.
Bill, would there be a problem if it was changed to say resolution instead of ordinance? Or Gary? Do you see a problem?
I don't want to screw up if it means federal money. It doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah, because this is a resolution, not an ordinance.
It is.
Section 3. If any section, paragraph, or provision of this ordinance shall be held invalid or unenforceable, the severability clause.
You're right, Mr. Chairman. It is a resolution, so we should change it. That.
By unanimous consent, we can change that.
Yeah, if it's boilerplate.
Any objection to changing that? Okay, by unanimous consent, that will be changed. Thank you. Anywhere that it says it, well, under 4, though, that should stay. That's different. Oh, right. Okay, twice in Section 3, it'll be changed. All right, by unanimous consent, we'll do that. Okay. Jerry Sobranek?
Excuse me, but are you going to word that the first reading of a resolution or the second reading of a resolution? Or it doesn't matter?
It's not an ordinance. Since we've now decided that it's a resolution, it only gets one reading. We'll keep it simple. Any other discussion? All in favor of the resolution, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried unanimously. Who seconded that? Anybody remember? Oh, Vicki Burke did, yeah. Okay, Tara Johnson, is that it for you?
Thankfully, yes.
Thank you. Health and Human Services Board, Sharon Hampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have resolution or item number 1210, acceptance of H1N1 flu prevention grant staff authorization. Whereas La Crosse County Health Department has been awarded a grant of $242,631 by the Wisconsin Department of Health and Family Services to aid with inoculations for the prevention of the H1N1 flu virus. Whereas said funds may be used to hire staff, contract with providers, and otherwise engage partners in the administration of the H1N1 flu vaccine and to pay for associated costs. Now, therefore, be it resolved that La Crosse County accept the grant of $242,631 from the Wisconsin Department of Health and Family Services. Be it further resolved that the Health Department is authorized to hire up to 2 full-time equivalent clerical staff and 2 full-time equivalent registered nurses as limited-term employees, or such other combination of LTE staff as necessary to carry out the intent of the grant. Be it further resolved that the Health Department is authorized to contract with other providers to aid the Health Department staff in the administration of the flu vaccine. Fiscal note, the estimated maximum cost for the grant period for 2 FT clerical positions is $48,876, and the estimated cost for 2 full-time RNs is $87,990 for a total estimated cost of $136,866. The balance of funds will be used to contract with other business partners and for administrative costs of the program. I move its approval.
Moved by Sharon Hampson, seconded by Jill Billings. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none, Jeff Schrader.
Why is it taking more people to administer the H1N1 flu vaccine than it would normally would for our regular flu vaccine?
Because normally we have the staff to do the regular seasonal flu vaccines. This is separate and apart from that, so we have not worked into our budget the administration of two different flu vaccines. This one also may end up being more extensively given than the seasonal flu vaccine.
Any other questions or discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously. Is that it for you, Ms. Hampson?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That gets us to items for future agendas. I want to remind people of dates coming up. First one is Tuesday, October 27th. The Executive Committee has its budget meeting, 3 o'clock Tuesday, October 27th. Policy planning then for the full board is Monday, November 2nd. And then don't forget, November is our county board budget process. So on Monday the 9th, we have our budget public hearing. That starts at 6 p.m. 5:30? Oh, right, yeah. 5:30 will be the other thing first, and then 6 o'clock will be the budget. And then Tuesday, starting at 9 a.m., will be the budget deliberations, Tuesday the 10th. So please make a note on your calendars. Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Past practice, after the conclusion of the public hearing, we've gone right into the budget and started going through agenda items. Is that going to also be okay this year, too?
I think so.
Okay. So we'll after we conclude the public hearing, we'll go right into the agenda for the annual meeting.
That would be my intention.
Okay.
Yes. Also, past practices that we've asked people to sign up if you want lunch for Tuesday, so we'll have that sign-up sheet probably at policy planning. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Ebert.
Thank you. I have some questions that I'd like to get answered for budget written down. Who do I give these to?
Probably to Gary or Steve.
Thank you much.
Okay. Any other? Vicki Burke.
Mr. Chairman, on Tuesday night, the 27th, is that recognition for by Justice Sanctions?
Right. That's at 6 o'clock. Executive's at 3. And if we need more meetings from executive, obviously staff will schedule whatever the board directs. While I have the microphone, I just wanted to remind, if there are school members that live within the school district of La Crosse, I've got these items here if people wanted those handouts for the Monday night linkage meeting.
Okay, anybody have any other announcements of any sort? Bob Kyle. Bob moves to adjourn, seconded by Jerry Sobranek. All in favor say aye. Opposed no. Carried.